An uneven vaccine rollout means an uneven economic recovery. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, April 5th. Good to have you with us. The International Monetary Fund is expected to deliver some good news for the global economy at its spring meeting tomorrow. Economic expansion is happening faster than the IMF had last predicted, somewhere north of 5.5%. But the global financial institution also has a word of caution. The headline number is hiding a lot of unequal growth. We're not all going to get out of this pandemic at the same time. In a speech today in Chicago, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen echoed the concerns, warning that uneven distribution of the vaccine could especially hurt developing countries. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, that may leave some lasting damage.
In a speech ahead of the IMF's week of meetings, Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva had this simple warning.
Economic fortunes are diverging.
The dividing line isn't neat and tidy between rich and poor countries, says Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The U.S. is looking good. India is looking good. China is looking good. Brazil, United Kingdom, Russia, and parts of Western Europe are not so good.
Latin America is in trouble, too. Part of this global divergence is in the vaccine. Some, mostly rich countries, have a lot of it. Most middle-income and poor countries have very little. But vaccines fight the virus. To fight recession, you also need money. Say, for example, trillions in stimulus, which lots of countries don't have. Masoud Ahmed is president of the Center for Global Development.
They don't have the space to either spend the money or to borrow the money from markets and sustain their businesses and their households.
There's also a cruel irony in the U.S.'s rapid economic recovery. As it and other countries spend their way to health, interest rates rise. Nathan Sheets is chief economist at PGIM, Fixed Income.
It tightens global financial conditions, and it means that emerging markets can experience capital outflows.
Meaning, as richer countries heal, it makes it a little harder for some poorer ones to do so. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
In healthcare news not related to the pandemic, a new federal rule takes effect today, giving patients more access to their medical records for free. Many health records are already available electronically, but it can be a hassle to get them. The new rule also changes what kinds of information patients can request. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
The rule makes it illegal for healthcare providers to engage in what's called information blocking, with fines of up to $1 million if they make it too hard for patients to get their records. Liz Salmi is a senior strategist for the group Open Notes, which advocates for transparency in medical records. She says if it weren't for the pandemic,
this concept of full transparency to everything in the record, the notes, the labs, pathology reports, would be the biggest story in healthcare.
As of today, patients should start being able to access all of that information and share it with healthcare providers, schools and workplaces, even third-party smartphone apps. Dr. Rachel Hendrick-Stirrup is the health lead at the Future of Privacy Forum and says once you get your records,
you, the patient, have control over where your health information goes, then it pretty much becomes a Wild West.
Because not all those apps or schools or even companies face the same privacy rules as traditional medical providers. Also, right now, many of those providers aren't ready to roll out all the changes. Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld is with the American Medical Association.
There's a lot of confusion. The legal requirements are complex, and it interfaces with third parties and data use agreements.
Not the kind of stuff they normally cover in med school. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street had plenty to cheer in the latest numbers from the U.S. economy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One consequence of schools being closed for in-person learning during the past year is that a lot of kids who rely on school meals have had trouble getting enough to eat. Now states are starting to open up applications for an expanded relief program. Families who qualify for free and reduced-price school lunches can now collect additional benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. School-age children, as well as those in preschool and daycare, are now eligible through the end of summer. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
The point of the pandemic EBT program is to get food to children who aren't getting their meals at school anymore. But there was a gap before the pandemic, summer.
When that last school bell rings, all of that infrastructure goes away.
Lisa Davis is with No Kid Hungry. She says to-go pop-up meals increased 160% last summer during the pandemic. But picking up meals can be tough for parents who may not have the time or a car. Judy Bartfeld researches food insecurity at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Even in the communities that do the best job of this, those summer meals are only reaching a fraction of the kids who normally get fed during the school year.
The new expansion of SNAP benefits will get more food into hungry mouths, says Lauren Bauer, who researches safety net policies at the Brookings Institution. She says before this pandemic EBT started, not all families who qualified for free or reduced lunch qualified for SNAP.
Pandemic EBT is meant to catch people who are falling into the gaps and to catch people who are not in school.
Researchers think this temporary expansion could bring permanent changes to the SNAP program. In fact, the USDA has actually been piloting a similar EBT program in a handful of states for almost a decade. Here's Bartfeld again.
I think when you have basically kind of a nationwide experiment showing that something new and different like this works and can be effective, it can create momentum for longer term change, certainly.
So far, 31 states have been approved to expand pandemic EBT. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Every morning, David Brancaccio and the team are up early, making sure you have the economic news you need to start your day. Check out the Marketplace Morning Report, will you? We learned in the latest jobs report that close to 500,000 women re-entered the workforce last month. That reverses a trend from last year when a lot of people, especially working mothers, faced difficult choices as they tried to balance work and parenting and health. For the next installment of our series, My Economy, we've got the story of one working mother and a decision she made.
My name is Whitney Robinson. I'm an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the Gilling School of Global Public Health. One of the most difficult decisions that I had to make as the pandemic got started was whether to keep my children in in-person daycare. I have a one-year-old and a five-year-old, and there was a point in March where everything seemed to shut down. Most daycares and schools around me were shutting down, but my daycare did not. They decided to stay open. My husband and I both work jobs that we could work from home, and so the alternative would have been to have them at home. My one-year-old in particular is very high energy, so I think we would have had to trade off and do shifts because it would be impossible to just have us both working with the kids running around. But it was important for me to be able to continue working during the pandemic because I wanted to pitch in. This global pandemic required so much energy and focus, and I wanted to use the training that I've built up over the past 20 years of grad school and being a professor to contribute to this all-hands-on-deck effort. I also wanted to make the decision carefully because I was thinking about the health and well-being of the daycare workers, some of whom are older, and honestly not paid at a high rate and not having access to high quality health insurance. And so I really had to think, what is the risk that my family could bring in this virus that would have effects on the daycare staff? Once I decided, okay, you need to make a decision, I actually did keep my kids home for a few days and I just read everything I could read. After those few days, I decided to keep my kids in childcare. I just took the opportunity to work as hard as I could in my community and larger research world. So it's a year later, and I think a lot of people are reflecting. What happened was the daycare stayed open. We closed for 1 2-week quarantine. No staff have gotten infected throughout the pandemic, thankfully. But I don't take it lightly because the data were limited at that point. And even as an epidemiologist, knowing that something is low risk does not mean that it's zero risk. And something bad could have happened, even in a low risk setting. And that weighs on me. And I have a PhD in epidemiology. I think of all the families out there and the directors of daycares and the school directors and the superintendents and the principals who are having to try to make these huge decisions. And there wasn't great sources of definitive guidance and support for them. And so I remain really hurt and upset and angry about that. I think I made the best decision I could, but it was hard and it was stressful. And I wish that burden hadn't been so much on us as individuals.
That was Whitney Robinson at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She wrote a Twitter thread, by the way, with more detail on the epidemiology behind her decision. You can find that and tell us about your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
I'm too busy. Like, I have too much to do.
Not a bad problem to have when you sell real estate. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 373 points, 1.1% to finish at 33,527. The NASDAQ rose 225 points, 1.6% to end at 13,705. And the S&P 500 gained 58 points, 1.4% to land at 4077. We heard from Kimberly Adams about increased access to medical records. GE, which makes a lot of medical imaging equipment, lit up 1.3% today. Abbott Laboratories rose 0.7%. Boston Scientific went up 1.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.70%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Before we get into this next story, just a heads up, we'll be talking about a sensitive topic that may not be appropriate for children. As the country moves closer to something like business as usual, an all-too-familiar story has reemerged. Over the past 3 weeks, 22 people have died in mass shootings in the U.S., Gun violence and the impact it has on kids is the subject of a new book by Washington Post reporter John Woodrow Cox. It's called Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I want you to start, if you could, telling me a little bit about Tyshawn and Ava and how they came to be friends.
So it was pretty remarkable, actually. Back in early 2017, I had set off on a series of stories for the Post pursuing kids who've been impacted by gun violence. And Tyshawn's father had been shot to death in the middle of the day in Southeast DC. So I wrote a story about the trauma that Tyshawn was dealing with. And by the time that story published, I had started reporting on a school shooting in South Carolina. There was a teenager, a 14-year-old boy, who pulled up at Townville Elementary School and had opened fire on a group of first graders. And he had killed a little boy named Jacob. And he was the best friend of a little girl named Ava. And Ava was dealing with a really debilitating trauma in the aftermath of that. So after I wrote the story on Tyshawn and it published, Ava's mother was reading it one day. And her mother told her a little bit about Tyshawn. And Ava decided that she wanted to write him a letter. She thought he needed a friend. So she wrote him a letter, and it began this pen pal relationship that then evolved into, you know, the two of them sending gifts back and forth to each other, and then often FaceTimes. They would talk quite a bit, and they just had this really unique relationship because they had shared trauma over gun violence.
Why did you want to focus on these children, not those killed by gun violence, but those who survive, those who've been affected by it?
So, you know, the core of this book is what was for me the epiphany. And that was that the scope of gun violence and how it affects children in America is so much broader than people assume. And Ava and Tyshawn, to me, illustrated that. Their lives have been profoundly affected, shaped forever by the losses that they've gone through and what they've witnessed. So, you know, we think of gun violence often as the hundreds or thousands of kids who die every year, but it's millions of children who are impacted directly or indirectly by this plague.
And surviving gun violence doesn't just cause, you know, loss and mental health issues, which you chronicle in the book, but can also cause financial hardships for the families who try to put the pieces back together. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ava has been to more than a half a dozen different therapists before she found one who could really connect with her. She's been through multiple psychiatrists. And in Tyshawn's case, it was the same thing. You know, he was his mother was trying to find someone. And it was a real struggle because either the insurance didn't cover it, or she just couldn't pay for it, or, you know, somebody who was too young. They once tried to see if a student, you know, going through psychology school could treat him, and she just wasn't willing to do that. So these kids just don't get the services they need. And if they do, it's, you know, incredibly expensive for the families.
Again and again in the book, a lot of this seems to come down to research and the lack of evidence about what works. And that's partly because it's hard to fund research about gun violence. Can you talk a little bit about how gun violence research is funded now and what role it could play in the future?
Yes. So that has set us back more than any other individual problem, is that in the 1990s, Congress passed what's called the Dickey Amendment. And it effectively banned the CDC from studying gun violence for two decades. Just in the past couple of years, was there finally a push to spend some money? But frankly, the money that Congress has devoted to research has been symbolic. It's been, you know, in the few tens of millions of dollars when we should be devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to this issue. If we studied this issue at the same rate that we study similar causes of death, we'd be devoting hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to this and would be able to say definitively, this law works and this one doesn't work. So this is what we should pass.
Of course, this conversation is all too relevant yet again with the recent mass shootings. There's a new administration and a new Congress in town. Do you see the political will changing about specifically funding research into what works?
I do think that we will see real progress with research. And it's in part because the dam was sort of broken even before the change in administration. You know, passing some of these more sweeping laws, some of which we know save lives, that could be harder to pass because you need the 60 votes. So, you know, that is sort of the big question in these weeks to come, can they get 60?
John Woodrow Cox, he's the author of the new book, Children Under Fire. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've got an excerpt from the book online about the nearly $3 billion market for school security and the unproven products that industry is selling. You can find that at marketplace.org. There is, you might have heard, a bit of a real estate boom going on in many parts of the country. That's creating some growing pains for newly hot markets, including Southern California's high desert near Joshua Tree National Park. The U.S. government used to give land away in this sparsely populated area. Now a housing rush is being fueled by the pandemic and a desire to get out of the city. And by social media that's marketing to a new generation of desert pioneers. But not everyone is benefiting from the demand. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb has that story.
Craig Higgins has lived and worked in big cities all over the world. New York, Seattle, London, Paris. But he moved most recently from L.A. and bought his dream home in an unlikely place, the middle of the desert.
Every property I looked at sold within 2 days, above asking price, so I knew something was going on here.
Here is Wonder Valley, 2.5 hours from Los Angeles. Population, less than 1,000. Eventually, Higgins says, he got lucky and bought a small home directly from its owner, in all cash, just under $50,000. It's a far cry from L.A. County's sizzling real estate market, where the median home price right now is more than $700,000. That's according to the financial services company CoreLogic.
I'm too busy. Like, I have too much to do.
Rob Grace is a real estate agent who specializes in desert living.
Because the price point is so low compared to the rest of California, Southern California, a lot of people all cash and people willing to forego appraisals and go way over asking price.
This red hot market may be good for agents, but it's also good for homeowners who've recently moved out to the high desert. Folks like Jess Madison, who lives down the road with her family.
I bought this place as an Airbnb, and that was in 2019, luckily, because it would be twice as expensive right now.
Wonder Valley is arid and sparsely populated, so it helps that Madison is able to work from home as a writer.
I think that's one of the reasons people are moving out here so much more, is that since the pandemic happened, everyone has been remote working.
But there are people who have lived here for decades, like LaRonda Jordan, and they're starting to have questions about what all this change might mean for them. She bought her house in 2003 for $84,000. Her house is fully paid for, but it needs repairs.
Most of my roof is blowing off, so it's kind of a toss-up between the roof, the water, the electric.
Jordan lives with her daughter and two great-grandchildren on 5 acres. This property, like most others in Wonder Valley, began as a homestead, land that the federal government gave away for free, especially in the 1950s, so long as you built something on the property. Her property now is worth close to $250,000. That's according to an estimate by the real estate firm Redfin. But Jordan says that increase in value hasn't helped her family. She doesn't plan to sell, and while she could refinance, she says she couldn't make the payments. At 70 years old, her only income is her widow's Social Security, $1,300 a month.
It's tight. That's why there's not much of a roof on the house.
Another big problem, water. There's no municipal system out here, so Jordan gets her water from a well, like many others. But the groundwater supply is limited, and Jordan is worried about how much longer it's going to last.
We have so many people moving out here from the cities that are putting in wells on their property. And every time they're putting in wells, the water table drops.
Jordan says she gets why someone would want to live out here. There's a freedom in the desert that you just can't replicate in the city. But with all the change, she's not sure if her way of life can last much longer. In Wonder Valley, California, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, I saw a picture on social media today that kind of sums up this economic moment. It was a bunch of people waiting for their vaccines inside a defunct Macy's department store. A price check sign was still hanging overhead. And the retail apocalypse accelerated by the pandemic is far from over. The investment bank UBS is out with a new report predicting another 80,000 stores will close permanently in the next 5 years as online shopping continues to grow. Stores selling sporting goods, office supplies, and clothing and accessories are in the biggest trouble, especially those in shopping malls. For your moment of economic context on this Monday, more than 4 million people in the United States received a COVID-19 vaccine on Saturday, according to the CDC, a new daily record. Progress, people. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.